And welcome to Sampler. I'm Brittany Luce, and today I'm going inside the Radio Mothership, NPR, with the women behind Invisibilia. So for those of you who don't know, Invisibilia is a podcast that explores ideas about science and emotion. And the women of Invisibilia are like some pretty heavy hitters in the podcasting game. Basically, since their show started in early 2015, it's not just been like critically successful, but like it's just really, really popular. Like people are so excited about this hour-long show about science. It sounds like it should be boring, but it's totally not. And the new season just launched. So welcome to the show, Elise Spiegel.
Hi.
Lulu Miller.
Hello.
And a newbie, Hannah Rosen.
Hi.
Welcome to Sampler, you guys.
Thank you.
Oh my God. It's like cool. It's like very cool that like, you know, that you guys are here, but it's also cool that I'm here because
I think it's more cooler that you're here.
I'll take that. Yeah. I'll take that. So Invisibilia is actually Latin for invisible things. And your show is all about invisible forces in our lives, like our beliefs, our assumptions, our relationships. So all of the clips I brought for you guys today sort of deal with these invisible forces. Get it? Like invisible, Invisibilia, right? I mean, you guys are smart, though, so obviously I knew you were going to get that one. But basically, the first invisible force that we're going to talk about today is love. Essential. Mm-hmm. We would agree, I think. So this clip comes to us from a brand new podcast called Love Me from CBC, which is Canadian radio. Lulu, I see you're like grinning right now. That's good. That's great. You excited?
Well, do you know it?
It's Crystal Duhaim and Mira Burt-Wintonek with Lou Olkowski.
Oh, wow.
Olkowski hosting. But, oh, shit. Am I not supposed to?
No, you're fine.
Did I just kill the game? Am I the worst? Okay. No, but you said that. Anyway, that's all I know.
Well, no, that's good. That's good. Okay. This is amazing. So Love Me episodes will be a mix of like short narratives and fiction that address our human and very deep desire to be loved. And the clip we're going to play for you actually comes from an episode that was just released today. So this story is called Love Rival. And it's a story told by one woman, Vanessa Woods, who is a science researcher. Vanessa talks about how she found herself in a very, very unusual love triangle.
Brian and I had just gotten engaged. I quit my job and went to work with him. And, you know, it was while we were working together one day that she showed up. She was totally beautiful. I mean, she had this long, dark hair and these almond-shaped eyes. And, I mean, from the second Brian saw her, I just knew he was gone. I would sort of, you know, walk up and interrupt them kind of like giggling together. And, you know, their heads kind of really close and he would like whisper little secrets to her. It was all just nauseating. They called her Malou, which is short for Marie-Louise. She was found in someone's hand luggage going through the X-ray machine at the Charles de Gaulle Airport. There is a thriving international black market for great apes, and Malou was a bonobo. Malou's mother was killed, and she was probably taken from her dead body and sold on this black market to be destined to be somebody's pet.
No, no.
Oh, the real one.
Brian and I were working at Lolly Our Bonobo, the world's only bonobo sanctuary. It's in this beautiful forest in the middle of Kinshasa in the Congo. Both humans and chimpanzees were male-dominated. We kill each other. We beat our females. Sometimes, you know, we kill the infants. And bonobos, who are so similar to us, they don't kill each other. And they're the only great ape that doesn't kill each other. When bonobos fall in love with you, it's a very specific experience. I'd fallen in love with bonobos a ton of times before. I mean, you know, Brian was always laughing at me. He wasn't going to sort of get sucked into this kind of like, you know, ape-hugging type relationship. But then when Malou chose him, he was just helpless. But as for me, I was the other woman, and she knew it. So she would kind of, you know, squint her eyes at me and give me dirty looks. And, you know, Brian didn't see any of it. We used to eat breakfast outside on the porch, and there was this one morning where Malu must have been watching us, because as soon as Brian went inside to get something or go to the bathroom, she ran down and just knocked over my tea, stole my toast, and then ran off. I used to see Brian play this game with her where he threw her up into the air as high as he could, and she would go completely limp. She would be like 7 feet in the air. I mean, if Brian had dropped her, she would have broken her neck. But she knew that Brian would never, ever let her fall. That no matter what, he would catch her. And it was this kind of trust that for me, it taught me what really being in love was. Because in order to be in love, you have to completely trust that person, even though you know that you don't have control on whether they catch you or not. After we left the sanctuary, Brian and I moved to America. Malu kept growing, kept flourishing, and there was talk of her being one of the bonobos who was going to be released into the wild. I still remember it was springtime and the dogwoods were flowering, and I was sitting outside at a cafe with one of my friends, and my phone rings and it's Brian, and his voice sounds very strange, it's broken. He just says, "Malu's died." I could just hear it. I knew then that he would never love a bonobo again like he loved Malu. He'll never fall in love like that again. A few years later, I found out that I was pregnant with our first baby, and she was a girl. And so I asked him, I'm like, "Do you want to call her Malu?" And he didn't say anything. But he smiled. And that's her name.
That's beautiful.
It's lovely.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. No. That was excellent. Beautiful. Perfectly, like, contained.
Their stuff is so relaxing. Like, I feel like I've gone I feel like stretched out. Like, I've gone swimming. Their mm-hmm. pace, they're, I don't know, they're pretty much always non-narrated. Like, or they're, it's, there's no reporter, and then they're just, yeah.
That's beautiful.
I liked that. I liked the image. I love, like, when you get a very clear image, and just that image of like a monkey possibly about to break its neck as a metaphor for yeah. trust. Like, that's a nice, yeah, it was a very nice image.
Yeah, when I heard that particular sentence the first time that I heard that clip, it was just so like illustrative to me of like what love is actually supposed to be about and how it's supposed to feel. But I also know that in the first season of Invisibilia, you guys did a lot of reporting about love, not just like romantic relationships, but also friendships, family relationships, successful and unsuccessful.
Did we?
Well, entanglement.
Yeah.
Definitely mom and daughter yeah. and how, like, the weird downside of empathy.
Okay, so just to fill you guys in at home, what we're talking about is Invisibilia's entanglement episode from the first season. So in this episode, Lulu and Elise introduce us to this woman named Amanda. And Amanda has this condition called mirror touch synesthesia. Basically, Amanda's body physically experiences what other people around her are feeling. So in the episode, they talk to Amanda's daughter about how Amanda's condition affects her.
Do you ever get, like, if you see a little kid spinning around and around, do you ever get dizzy?
Makes me want to throw up, like, four of them.
Really?
Yeah, four of them.
Is it hard to watch other people eat?
I hate it. Like, icky, nasty, squishy feeling in your mouth.
And then she told me about the hives.
Like, you may see my mom, like, scratching her neck a lot because she gets really nervous and she has little hives, and I get them too because I see her doing it. See, I've got...
I can barely see,
yeah,
but
yeah, it's because I always cover them up with makeup because I get it too.
Really?
Yeah.
So I had to ask again. Do you think you have mirror touch synesthesia?
Possibly, but I don't want to end up like her. Because, I mean, she's... I don't want to be rude, but it's like wasted talent. She knows so many languages, and she's an artist, and she has so much potential and talent, and she doesn't do anything.
Amanda's paintings, those bright and swirling canvases, hang all over the walls of her daughter's room. Are you the one that puts all her paintings up?
Mm-hmm. She doesn't like to show them.
Do you like them?
Yeah.
What do you like about them?
Because it's her emotions.
Are you worried that you're the same way?
Kind of.
But she does everything she can to be different. As overstimulating as the world can be, she's constantly going out with friends.
I'm always trying to get out. I don't like how quiet it is here. It sucks. Nobody talks here. I guess it's because we feel each other all the time.
And suddenly, there are tears in her eyes.
What is that? What is that about? We don't talk.
This idea that you could catch someone's feelings and eat them, basically, like make them your own, that they could become yours, that you could catch things that other people were doing in such a profound way that you would mistake them for your own feelings,
mm-hmm.
it was a revelation to me,
mm-hmm.
and something I'd been thinking about with my own mother, that I would like walk into the air with my own mother and I would just like pick up her own sort of anxiety and feelings and kind of ingested in a way that wasn't really true to me, mm-hmm. like that wasn't mine, and kind of got in the way of our relationship in some way.
So before we get to our next clip, I wanna ask you just a little bit more about like the show, a little bit more about the second season. Is there like a specific theme that you guys were going for with this whole season? Anything on your minds?
I think we wanted to take the frame that we established last season, mm-hmm. and take it to different places, which we have. So last season we did a lot of there were a lot of neurological extremes,
mm-hmm.
And that was, and pretty much every episode had somebody who was neurologically different.
Yeah.
And this season we only have one. And otherwise it's basically like looking at these same kind of
invisible forces.
These same forces and these same systems, mm-hmm. like conceptual systems, emotional systems, but it's looking at them in like places like your workplace or the criminal justice system or terrorism. Like it's like
just small stuff.
Just small stuff. Like we went big. So like it's big. It's bigger. It's better. And there's 50% more hosts.
I was exactly what I was about to get to.
I'm just going to say that over and over again.
Yeah, I've noticed that you guys, the team has expanded now having, you know, Hannah on board.
Uh-huh.
And also Hannah, like, Invisibilia is, it's a weekly, hour-long deep dive of just, like, really intense reporting. And, I mean, you know, obviously there may be people who are listening who know you in, a podcast context, but, like, as a writer, you are, like, a serious...
deep diver.
Yeah, you're a serious journalist.
That's why Invisibilia is like not serious. No. it's very similar to the writing I have done for magazines,
but not
working on Invisibilia stories. It's like a different topography, different landscape, but the way of going about it, the way of conceiving a story, the depth of it is similar. Like the amount of time it takes, that part, mm-hmm. feels familiar to me.
So that feels familiar to you from your writing, but your podcasting, you come from Slate's
Gabfest.
Gabfest,
yeah.
Right.
The Gabfest culture is more like it's more like writing for Slate. I mean, it's just, it's like the 1,000-word piece versus the 10,000-word piece. So the GabFest keeps you in the vein of news.
So to give listeners a sense of how different the two shows are, let's just hear a little bit from a recent episode.
David Brooks wrote a column about Hillary Clinton, in which he suggested that maybe one of the reasons that people can't relate to her is because she's too much of a workaholic and essentially doesn't have a hobby. So he writes, "Can you tell me what Hillary Clinton does for fun? We know what Obama does for fun. Now listen to what he defines as for fun: golf, basketball, etc." Okay. So the question is,
it's all in the et cetera.
If only golf, basketball, and woodworking are defined as hobbies, it's natural for us to ask, like, what the hell? Are hobbies sexist? Do we just not perceive the things that women do for fun as hobbies? What do you guys think?
Well, first of all, I can tell you what Hillary Clinton's hobbies are, in case you would like to know, as a student of Hillary Clinton.
That's another channel that I have that I really like. Like, I like to just talk about what's going on in the world in the moment. But that's just not at all what Invisibilia. But I've always been split that way.
She still does it.
I still does it. I've always been split between, like deep dive mind, shallow dive mind.
So we actually are going to do some deep diving of our own into some more invisible forces after we take a quick break. Welcome back to Sampler. I am in the District of Columbia with the Invisibilia team, Elise Spiegel, Lulu Miller, and Hannah Rosen. And everybody say hi.
Hi.
So today on the show, we are talking with the women of Invisibilia, who have just launched their second season. And we are going deep into some of the invisible forces that shape our lives. So we started with love. And the next clip we're going to play is about another powerful emotion that can drive us sometimes, for better or for worse, fear.
Fear.
Yes, fear. So what I'm going to play for you guys is one of my favorite moments from this podcast, How to Be Amazing with Michael Ian Black. So Michael Ian Black is a comedian and an actor. And in this show, he interviews other performers and writers just trying to find out how they got to be so amazing. So in this episode, Michael is interviewing the Broadway singer and actress Audra McDonald. So she's done everything from film to television to stage, and she's actually really close to an EGOT. She, like, has an Emmy, a Grammy, and more than a few Tonys. The only thing she actually doesn't have is an Oscar. So in this moment, she's talking about this one aspect of success that she still finds really hard.
When you get off the stage afterwards, what is your emotional state? Is it, where are you emotionally?
That's interesting. That's something I'm really trying to work on, because usually I go into sort of, you know, beating myself up or being negative about what I've just done, as opposed to being grateful that look what I get to do for a living. And I am starting to understand that, you know, people's experience of it can be something completely different than what you experience. And in the end, in that respect, it's not for you. It is for them. And a lot of times when people come backstage to say, you know, great job or whatever,
they mean it.
They mean it.
You can take that compliment.
Well, and to take the compliment.
Right.
That's part of thanking them. And if you don't, that's a slap in the face to them. And that's what I'm just now really starting to learn.
That's interesting to me, because although I do not place us at all in the same category in any way, shape, or don't you dare. Although I do not place ourselves in the same category. That's a lesson I learned years ago.
Really? How?
Well, because my instinct was always to bat away the compliment, to sort of do the, oh, you don't care about me, and mean it. Like, not in a self-effacing way, like literally mean
it. Right, exactly.
And what I realized is those encounters with people, when they approach you, were not about me at all.
Exactly.
And that to give them that moment for them, because it's important for them to express something, whether or not you feel like you earned whatever they're trying to express or not.
Right, and it is truly about them, and the moment is about them. You know, I used to pass out a lot when I would perform. I would faint dead away.
A lot?
Yeah. look it up.
I know the one sort of famous story about your original audition for Carousel.
Yeah, and then there's the Rosie O'Donnell tribute. When I was back in Juilliard, I passed out in the middle of my English diction recital. I passed out in a concert. It happened. Uh-huh. It's happened a lot. It was finally diagnosed as vasovagal syncope, and which means that my body, when I get overexcited, my blood pressure goes up and my body says, oh, blood pressure's too high, we've got to regulate it. So instead of going back to like a normal spot, my body resets completely back to zero, which means unconsciousness. It's just like, oh, let's start over. Let's start over as if the day is starting over and you're just waking up. As I've gotten older and performing, I'll still sometimes get that sense of, oh gosh, in special situations, like if I have to perform for somebody really famous, I'm performing at the White House. In those situations now, what I often tell myself, this is going to circle back to the point, which is this isn't about you. And if you go out at someone else's memorial service because you're super nervous and you pass out, then you're making it about you. That's mm-hmm. selfish. Get a hold of yourself, girl. Mm-hmm.
That was an unusually good exchange.
Yeah.
For interviewer, interviewee.
Right.
Because the pace of it was very fast and had no awkwardness. So there was a genuine chemistry between two people where they were talking like people who knew each other a long mm-hmm. time, which does not often happen in a public interview. And second of all, because it was about a set of themes that was deeper and other than what they were actually talking about. So it's like, when is humility real? Who are you performing for? Who are compliments for? How should you behave in compliments? Like, it was actually about something other than the thing, which also is rare in an interview. Mm-hmm. Usually it's like, when did your career start? How did you get? It's just about the thing itself, right? Mm-hmm. But this was about a set of emotional, psychological, and almost philosophical themes that were, like, deeper and richer than the words.
Well, I also liked it, too, because, like, I never imagined. So, like, growing up, I, like, really wanted to go to musical theater school. That was, like, my dream. Like, literally, up until it came time for me to, like, audition to go to college. And I was like, I don't want to do this. This was, like, my
Where
life.
Did you grow up?
Farmington Hills, Michigan. It's a suburb outside of Detroit. People in southeastern Michigan are kind of into musical theater. But, I idolized Audra McDonald. And I never in a million years thought that she would be somebody who had performance anxiety. Or somebody who, like, really grapples with that regular everyday human thing of like how to just take a compliment and how to deal with like nerves and the fact that like something just isn't about you.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has something like that they like in their day-to-day life that scares them. What scares you guys about your work? Oh God, sharp intake of breath collectively.
I'm scared of hurting people.
How do you mean? Elise.
Well, I mean, I think it's really, really scary to be a journalist. You take people's lives in your hands, mm-hmm. and you can do a tremendous amount of harm.
Mm-hmm.
Because people live by their narratives, right?
Well, you can hurt not just the people that you're reporting on, but you can also, if you tell certain, this is very true in essentially my beat, which is human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the stories that we have this season is about this new procedure, let's say, mm-hmm. for Asperger's, which allows people who are unable to see emotion to see emotion.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Now, that is a very, 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 very dangerous story to tell because people are really, they're really desperate to, like, address Asperger's. And if you give them a certain kind of story, then the truth is that that procedure is nowhere near being a cure to Asperger's, but because it exists, places are cropping up which are offering that procedure
mm-hmm.
And saying that it will cure Asperger's. So, like, these are really complicated stories. A lot of the material that we do, they're really complicated stories to tell.
Delicate, too.
They can have repercussions in the lives of the people that you're talking to, and that scares the shit out of me. Like, it truly, truly does.
What about you, Lulu?
The thing I struggle with more personally is just, like, I am terrified of confrontation, and that can sometimes make being a reporter hard. Like, I still get scared to pick up the phone and call someone. Like, that has not gone away.
Just like that regular, like, just the
jitters.
Yeah.
And it's like, the little Northeastern polite person that I was raised to be is like at odds sometimes with doing my job well.
I can understand that.
So that's my constant fear is like, be direct, ask the thing, like, and that's something I'm always pushing through.
That's something I actually deal with too, because I have the little polite Midwestern person.
Yeah,
I was raised to be. Yeah. What do you do like in the moment when you're kind of like on that seesaw of like, should I be direct or should I just not?
I think weirdly, when the mic is on, I am a little more like there, it's now over time, like with conditioning, I'm like headphones and mic, and now I'm this person, like in this space,
because I
know I'm going to be accountable to it. Like, it's like the sick side of me that's like, you need the tape, you know? And so I think it's like still harder, weirdly, in the pre-interview or like when we're just humans. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I do is like, I just pretend I'm someone else for an hour. Like, there's something nice about
I've never thought about that.
Oh, yeah. My first trick was B. Sally Herships, who was like this sweet but like direct, confident reporter who was one of the first reporters I met when I was an intern at WNYC. Uh-huh. And she would just go out and get great man on the street tape. And she was just like, Sally Herships asking a question in Times Square. And it was fine. And I was like, Lulu Miller can't go up to people and ask them questions, but Sally Herships can. And like, I'd be like, hi. And you could do it for an hour, like the time constraint.
Mm.
So that's my trick, be Sally Herships.
Oh my gosh, that's you actually gave me like a super.
You can be
piece
Sally Herships.
So we talked to you guys about fear. We've talked to you guys about the heartbreaking death of a bonobo. We're gonna lighten it up a little bit. Is that cool?
Yes.
Yeah.
So our last clip comes to us from a podcast called The Illusionist, which is all like The Illusionist with an A, not an I. It's all about how we use language, which is why it has this wonderfully puntastic title. Everything from the origins of certain words.
Did you just words, say the word puntastic?
Puntastic, exactly. But so The Illusionist is about language and word choice and what the words we say actually say about us. It's hosted by Helen Zaltzman, and what you're going to hear is Helen interviewing a woman whose entire job is all about choosing the right words.
What is an audio describer?
So I describe TV programs and films for blind and visually impaired people.
Alice's job, in a nutshell, is to watch the film or TV program, write a script describing what's happening on screen, then record that to fit in around the dialogue when the piece in question is broadcast.
What is the worst thing to do?
Dance movies, which I describe many of, the whole Step Up series.
Wow, how many
are... Oh, there's like, I don't know, 15, maybe 47 now. There's a lot.
Dancers march on the spot and sink to their knees. Emily smiles in wonder. Mr. Anderson looks around, heavy-browed. A guy appears to fall from one of the top containers. His arms flail as he falls, but miraculously he bounces back up and stands on the edge of the container. He and another guy proceed to plummet from the container, bounce back up and spin. The audience can't see a trick.
This is Alice's description of a dance sequence from the fourth Step Up film, Step Up Revolution. So what's so bad about describing dance films, Alice?
Well, the point of dance is that it is a different way to communicate that is not words. And so translating that back into words, it just ends up being horrifying. And especially if you're describing something like street dance, not ballet, it ends up sounding just ridiculous. And you can say like things like robotically or, I don't know, fluidly to get a sort of a feel across, you know, but it just is, it's like you work all day long and they take forever because obviously describing like minutes and minutes of dance sequences is really difficult. You look at your work at the end of the day and it's like, you've just carved this hideous statue that you can't bear to look at. And you just go home very dissatisfied.
Only to come back and do the next Step Up film.
Yeah, I did actually threaten to leave if my boss ever gave me another dance film.
The guys walk up to the side of the container and do death-defying flips and spins. The audience loves it. The container guys somersault through the air. Incensed, Trip goes over to a uniformed policeman. The cop turns robotically. He's actually a dancer. He shoves a donut in Trip's mouth.
All right, who said the best pictures were on the radio?
Wow. This is all I'm doing for the rest of my life is listening to audio descriptions
of dance movies.
That is the entire. I will never listen to a podcast again. That was the best thing I ever heard in my life. That was just brilliant. And that woman is a genius. A metaphor of the ugly statue.
The hideous statue. I look at my day's work and see a hideous statue.
That is awesome.
That is that's
oh my God, it's awesome to be in a job which you just, like, we all have this idea of what a horrible job is like. It's like death destroying, but it's no, you're killing the thing outside yourself.
Yeah.
You're just, yeah. And you're describing it. You're just murdering it with your work. It's so good.
But that would be a great like
the audio describer.
Would that be good for invisibility?
Oh my God. Like, so good.
It seems like season 2 is kind of is like over and out, but possibly season 3.
Yeah.
Well, there is something from season 1 that you guys started, Lulu and Elise, that I am hoping is still in season 2. You know, at the end of your show sometimes you guys have like a moment of zen.
Non-zen.
You have a moment of non-zen. And you guys have a little dance party.
Yes.
Yes.
Are you guys going to bring that back in season 2?
You wanna, do you want to dance?
Yes, I do want to dance.
Oh, and then you can narrate it. You can describe it.
Yes. Okay, here we go.
Right.
Okay,
wait a second.
Go over there so she can see.
Okay, guys. So just so you know, I am about to try being an audio describer, and I'm going to describe Invisibilia dancing. So let's see how that goes.
Okay.
All right, we're going to dance.
Wait, should I, you know what, should I play some music?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm playing Formation by Beyonce.
Okay, no, but we need
louder.
No, there's like, see Lulu's dance. Okay, so Lulu started dancing.
5, 4, 3.
Han is counting down. Okay, all three of them are doing this dance that actually reminds me of like the dinosaur, and now they're all waving their hands above their head. And now they're doing something, I can't recognize it, but it looks like a very strange gang symbol. And everybody's doing a rap squat.
It's an eye.
It's an eye. It's
invisibility.
That was beautiful, you guys.
No. No, it really.
Seriously.
It looks like a dinosaur was my...
No, that was... But what we were doing, just so that you know, we were doing...
It was a pony.
Pony. Pony. Pony. Pony. Lasso. 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 Lasso.
Invisibility.
Well, Lulu... Hannah, Elise,
Brittany,
thank you guys so much. This was like so much more than I bargained for. Who knew that I was going to... The dancing, really.
Yeah, I know. It kicks it up a notch.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Gosh.
Used to be a serious journalist.
Once upon a time.
And then I did the pony. Hey, Lulu. So what time is it?
Oh, it's science o'clock, it's science o'clock, it's time for science.
Sorry.
This is just,
we were
we came up with it the other day, we didn't end up using it in the show, and so now we're forcing you
to listen
to it.
If you want to hear more Invisibilia, episodes come out every Friday wherever podcasts are found. And you guys, we are actually going to be taking off for the next 2 weeks because it's summer, and summer is for fun, but... we don't want to leave you hanging. So here's what we're going to do. Send us your favorite podcasts about summer adventures, episodes that are great for long road trips, or your idea of a beach listen, or just a few minutes from an episode that really captures the carefree, sunny spirit of summer, the cookouts, the picnics in the park, outdoor drinking, and blasting a nice, cool podcast. So please send your suggestions to sampler@gimletmedia.com. This episode was produced by Kate Parkinson Morgan, Rose Reed, Sarah Abdurrahman, and myself. It was edited by Annie Rose Strasser. Our theme music was made by Mike Avellian, and our ad music was made by Mark Phillips. The show was mixed by Matthew Bull. Sampler is a production of Gimlet Media.